This is the sound of climbers on Mount Everest. In this video I shot last year, they're crossing the Khumbu Glacier. That's the highest glacier in the world. And yet, a lot of the ice up there is quickly turning into water and forming strange ponds and paddles surrounded by melting ice towers and seracs. Conrad and Dawa, you've both spent a lot of time on that glacier. Should we be worried about how climate change is transforming the mountain?
An unequivocal yes.
Yes, of course.
And do you think there's anything we can do about it?
We can, but I think the focus right now in the short term should be on saving ourselves more than saving the mountain, because I think the mountain is going to be here much longer than we're going to be if we keep on doing what we're doing.
Near term, it's going to be very difficult.
Welcome. This is On Thin Ice, a podcast by Iceworm Media in partnership with the Bali Peak Outlook Foundation. We bring together the best athletes, scientists, and innovators to discuss concrete solutions for accelerating the transition to a more sustainable way of living. I'm your host, Paolo Bossanin, and I'm just stoked to welcome our amazing guests today. Let's put it like this. If you've watched any film about alpinism or mountaineering, then you've heard his name before. Conrad Anker is a legendary American climber. He's appeared in a number of documentaries, The Wildest Dream, Meru, Torn, Fine Lines, just to name a few. And now he joins the On Thin Ice podcast. It's an honor to speak to you, Conrad.
Thank you, Paolo. Appreciate being here.
You're currently in Nepal. How's the climbing going over there?
Yeah, I spent the winter here in Nepal, specifically the Khumbu area. So we started out with the Khumbu Climbing Center, vocational training for high altitude Nepalis and climbing enthusiasts, and celebrated 20 years of that, and then went ice climbing for a month, and then the first 10 days of March, clinicking and climbing with the Icefall doctors, who you got a chance to meet with last year.
And with you in Kathmandu, we have another superstar. And I'm not just saying that because we're friends. Dawa Steven Sherpa is an entrepreneur, a mountaineer, and crucially, a prominent climate advocate in Nepal. He's a board member of the Bali Peak Outlook Foundation. And well, he's basically the co-creator of this podcast. Thanks for accepting my invitation to come on as a guest. Dawa, you run an expedition company, and is it busy right now?
Yeah, the short answer is it's very busy. Everest seems to get busier and busier. The mountains of Nepal do seem to get busier and busier, and there's been a boom since after COVID.
Well, that's very relevant to our main question today, which is how can we protect Mount Everest and other pristine mountains from the environmental crisis they are facing? You mentioned there's a boom. As many as 60,000 tourists visited the Everest Valley last year, bringing, of course, dollars and business opportunities, which is great for Nepal's economy. But tourism also brings some big environmental challenges. Garbage and pollution is a big one, especially as climate change is completely transforming the mountain. So I'd like to start with that. Conrad, you've been traveling to Everest for 3 decades. How much has the landscape changed since you first visited?
Yeah, my first trip to the Khumbu Valley was in 1990, and we climbed Amma de Blam. And looking back this past winter, and then correlating my visual experience with images from 1990 that the photographer Chris Noble took on our expedition, it's amazing how much of the high altitude cryosphere. And so the cryosphere is the ice mass that's in the mountains, everything from hanging glaciers with seracs to larger glaciers to ice frozen in between the cracks, the glue that holds those mountains together. But in looking at the mountains, they look anemic. It's just been so warm. There's been 2 warm monsoons and 2 warm winters. And so Nepal is even though there are 4 seasons, there's 2 seasons that define Nepal and really go in there. And the key part about the monsoon is the greatest snow accumulation and also the greatest snow loss is in that period. Winter's cold and windy, the jet stream comes down. It's that break in the jet stream before the monsoon comes up that allows climbers to get up Everest. But in seeing this now, the mountains just look, they're very dry. And to back this up, always listening to other climbers, Andres Gardiel, the Polish skier that skied down Camp 2, they were in Everest Base Camp 2 years ago, post-monsoon, to catch good snow. And at Everest Base Camp, it rained every day. And they were just like, we were watching ice melt before our eyes. And so if it's warm, that's one thing, but you compound that with water, and it's very obvious. The Khumbu Glacier is receding, but also at that same time deflating, and there's less volume and mass on the glacier.
Dawa, how would you describe those changes as a person who grew up here and whose family has been in the valley for generations?
Conrad's been here a long time. I've been here a fraction of that time. I would say maybe half that time in the mountains. In the last 20 years, I myself have seen so much changing. And I go to Everest Base Camp every year. And every year, the pinnacles are lower, the pinnacles at base camp, the ice pinnacles. And then you also see the level of the glacier getting lower and lower. So, I've seen it in my own lifetime. And my family's been in the Khumbu now for 19 generations. We've been there. And so from what I hear from my father and then my uncles, it's a very different place than what they grew up with. I'll give you a very clear example just within my own family. My dad was one of the first kids to learn to speak English in Sir Edmund Hillary School. And as such, he got a job as an interpreter at the age of 11. And he went with a Japanese team when he was 11 years old to Lhotse, which is just south of the Everest Massif. And there they camped at what is today the Imja Lake. If you go to Imja Lake today, it is about 2 kilometers long, over a mile long. I think it's over 100 meters deep. But when my dad was there 60 years ago, that was all ice. And, he remembers actually being on the glacier, playing on the glacier. Now you need a boat to go where he was. So that's a huge change in just one generation.
So basically there are lakes that didn't exist before. Glaciologists say they actually threaten the local populations. And Imja Lake is a big one and one of the main ones, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And we live with sort of the emotional aspect of it, not the academic aspect of it. And I'll explain what I mean by that is we get a lot of researchers who come there, and I've worked with quite a few teams as well who go there and research, what has changed in the last decades, how deep is the lake, how big is it, how fast is it growing, and so on. But I've also been on the other end of the emotional side, which is that 2 years ago, a small little pond broke out at the Lhotse Glacier. It wasn't the Imja Glacier, it was the Lhotse Glacier, which is there side by side. And then the phone started ringing all over the Khumbu, and even here in Kathmandu at 2 a.m. in the morning, I got a call saying that Imja Lake had burst out, and all the people were running. And I had to call everybody I knew, and I had to tell them, like, get to higher ground right away. And I have a little lodge down in Fabing, and I have people there, and I had to tell them, run, get out of the valley, get to high ground as quickly as possible. And this wasn't the first time. It's happened as well about 8 or 9 years ago, when the entire valley evacuated, when they thought that Imja had burst out. And this is going to happen more and more, because it's not just Imja. There's far more glacier lakes now forming in the mountains. And that's a very big concern for us, because it's not just a glacier melting into a lake. It's actually threatening the lives and also the livelihoods of the people there. So if one were to burst out and people did survive it, what then? They've lost their homes, they've lost their fields, they've lost their cattle, they've lost everything. So then how do you go into the future? So those are concerns that me and my family live with.
Conrad, as a foreigner, how do you feel about what you see when you see the mountain and its people affected by climate so much?
Yeah, it's a treat to be a guest in the Khumbu and to experience it, and I enjoy being there for the mountain scenery and moreover the people and the culture that are there. And welcoming. And on a personal level, with the Khumbu Climbing Center, we began our program 20 years ago in partnership with Nepali climbers. And we would go skiing during the course. In this last two seasons, there hasn't been enough snow for the villagers to ski in the potato fields and on the slopes around town, which is a big, everyone loves skiing. And skiing is an all-encompassing term. It includes children on kerosene jugs sliding down the mountain and other people, anything that slides, there's all sorts of, but it's a joyous moment. And it's also very important for the sustainability of these communities. They need the moisture, the precipitation for their potatoes and barley.
Can you just tell us in one sentence what the climbing center is?
To encourage responsible climbing practices in the community and supportive-based program. So that's the overall mission statement, but vocational training for Nepali climbers. Not necessarily high-altitude workers, but anyone from Nepal that wants to learn more about climbing, whether from a professional sense or they're just inquisitive and they want to learn how to climb. So 1,480 students, so we're 20 shy of the 1,500 mark, have graduated. And we talk about science, we talk about climate, we teach earth sciences and natural wildlife appreciation in the course of the program.
So we've talked about the visible, very real consequences of warmer temperatures in the Khumbu Valley. To complete this picture, if you look at those magnificent Everest landscapes today, there's another thing you'll notice, and that's a lot of garbage. Famously, Everest was labeled the world's highest garbage dump in many sensationalistic headlines by the foreign press, including National Geographic. And yet, when I came over to base camp last year, Dawa, I saw much, much less pollution than I was expecting, as you and I have been talking about. That's also thanks to you, although I know you don't want to get credit for it, because you've been working to address this issue for many years. Can you please tell us what you have done and also what's left to do?
So when I first started climbing, I went to Everest in 2007. And it was a particularly disgusting incident that, you know, I realized that Everest was pretty bad, right? It needed to be cleaned up. Basically, I had to set up camp on top of an old toilet site. And that experience, you know, haunts me to this day. It was really sad for me because, you know, we pray to the mountain. She is considered holy. Yet, you know, we were polluting her. And I think, you know, at that time, what I thought was that it was up to us, the mountaineers, and especially the Sherpas who are there all the time, go in, year out, to do something about it. Because the foreign mountaineer, unlike Conrad, of course, and a few like him, the foreign climber will only come once in their life, and then they will never come back again. But we are there year in, year out, and it was up to us to do it. And in the past, cleaning mountains, any mountain, let alone Everest, cost so much money. So it was in 2007 that I realized an opportunity, and that opportunity was the fact that all the Sherpas were going up with a lot of loads, and setting up camps, you know, depositing the oxygen and food, fuel, and then coming back down with empty backpacks. And so what I did was I reached out to all my buddies, all my friends, all the Sherpas at base camp, and I said, hey, listen, if you find any trash on the way down, just collect it and bring it to base camp to me, and every day we'll weigh it. And I called it weighing and the paying. So the whole scheme, I called it cash for trash. Now, I didn't think it was going to be that successful, to be honest. The first year I ran it, the next year, that was after 2007 to 2008, I ran it for the first time. And in that one season, I ran out of money very quickly. We ended up collecting 6 tons of garbage just that one year. And in subsequent years now, there's been less and less and less garbage that, you know, we've been collecting. So much so now that at least at base camp, I can, you know, say that there's no garbage. The only time that we now find garbage at base camp is right after the monsoon, when the glaciers melt, and when my Sherpas go there, all the old garbage has been melting out. I have even found a little bottle, an aspirin bottle or medicine bottle with an expiration date from 1962. And this is all being, you know, this is all swallowed up by the glacier many decades ago, and this is getting spit out now. You know, the lower parts of the mountain we've been cleaning, you know, I'd been cleaning, but the upper parts of the mountain were always tough for me to do, simply because, you know, just asking people voluntarily to do it was not going to cut it, because it requires technical gear, oxygen, you know, and a lot more dedication. And so that's when Bali, you know, and I partnered up, and we set up a cleaning team that would go into the dead zone right up to the summit and clean right from the top to the bottom. And that's how that partnership grew. And to this day, now we've done every year cleanups at base camp. We've done cleanup at every single base camp of an 8,000 meter in Nepal. And we are committed to keep doing this until there's no garbage left. And, you know, I'm very proud to say that we've collected more than 26,000 kilograms of garbage until now. And we'll keep at it. And we've also taken the lessons learned on Everest, and we've used it in the lower down valleys with projects like the Carry Me Back project. And we can talk about that a little bit later.
Well, just for context, before we do, listeners should, of course, appreciate how hard it is to bring garbage or anything back from, not only from the top of Everest, for obvious reasons, because you're at Camp 4, I think you're at 8,000 meters, so it is quite challenging even just to get there, let alone bringing down stuff, right? But also the rest of the valley, like the whole Khumbu Valley and the trails that lead to base camp, there's more than 30 miles of trails that aren't accessible to vehicles. And so all of that basically needs to be brought down either by foot or sometimes by helicopter. It needs to be flown out. So what is Carry Me Back, and why is it helping?
Carry Me Back is a project that the Bali Peak Outlook Foundation is supporting, and it's being implemented by the Sagarmatha Pollution Control Committee and our local partner, Sagarmatha Next, as well. And basically, it is utilizing the problem source as also being the solution. And what I mean by that is, the tourists are the ones that are creating the pollution, and or directly or indirectly, right? And so all this pollution, this garbage goes into the local pits and so on. You know, the pits have been growing and growing, and the garbage is being burned and then buried, which is not good for the air, is not good for the ground, or just being left alone, which is not good for the ground, not good for groundwater, and definitely not good for the wildlife who come to dig it out. So Carry Me Back basically is collecting all this garbage, old as well as newly produced garbage, separating it and then shredding it into little manageable bags of 1 kilo each that any tourist or any trekker who is going down to Lukla can voluntarily carry down. And this has been very successful. The collection center right now is in Namche, and already 10 tons of garbage has been taken down to Lukla. And at Lukla, the local airlines have committed to fly the garbage for free and have already done so. So they've done it for the last 3 or 4 seasons now, bringing all this garbage from the Everest region to Kathmandu for free. And in Kathmandu, we have a garbage recycling company called Blue Waste to Value, and they then take it over and then they upcycle it or recycle it. So it's sort of like closing that loop and bringing all the garbage down and keeping the Khumbu clean sustainably.
So there's a lot going on in Nepal right now in this space. Now there are new rules for tourists who visit. And can you tell us a little bit, what has the Nepalese government put in place, and is it enough?
It's not perfect, and it's an ongoing dialogue, right? But it is a step in the right direction. The one that is very famous right now all around the world, people are talking about it, is, you know, having to carry poo bags off the mountain, off of Everest. I mean, I've been doing it since 2008 already. I know that Conrad and the wider climbing community has been doing it for many years before that.
Yeah, there's the human waste on the glacier is definitely a consideration. So, and it has a multiplying effect, because then people get sick if they're at the South Col, is debilitating, and then it puts people at risk. And then now the outflow by Dugla has a pretty high E. coli count, and that's coming from human waste that's been on the glacier and then just sort of flowing out of there. Props to Dawa for changing the narrative, how people approach waste and how to look at it, and sort of getting a nationwide part of it. But a lot of the rubbish that we see on Everest is distracting. It's visual, a lot of microplastics that are in there. But what's really changing the glaciers, the ice of the Himalaya, is people like myself getting in a jet and flying across oceans to get there to visit. And the other part, I was in the Khumbu this winter for 78 days, and I began my trek from Lukla, and I finished my trek from Lukla. And the amount of people that hike to base camp or to Kalapatar and then fly out is, I mean, that there's something. And I was there at the helipad helping out with some friends and overheard this conversation from a couple that was waiting to get picked up. And they were like, oh, this is the best, and it's so boring, and we've already seen it. And they were kind of justifying the price they were paying for the helicopter by saying they weren't going to see anything. But you hike down the valley, you have an entirely different view. So encouraging people to go as minimal as possible, and then to hike. And hike is hike out, hike in. Helicopters are there for rescue. They're there for human resources and things like that. I was rescued with a helicopter in 2016, and so I see their value. But the amount of heli tourism up and around base camp is something that needs to be studied and understood.
Yeah, not only the heli tourism, but just tourism in general. I don't think I'm not aware of any study being done about what the carrying capacity is of the Everest region in terms of number of tourists. And, you know, adding to Conrad's point here about, you know, studying what heli tourism impacts might be, we need to do a larger study of what the impacts will be when the road finally touches Lukla and people are no longer dependent on the seasonal flights, but can drive any time of the year, all seasons to the Everest region. I think we're going to be seeing numbers go from 60,000 a year to 600,000 people a year. And then what's going to happen? So I think, again, coming back to the point about the local government making these rules and regulations, I think it's good because they've started to already take into consideration the future. And I think they need to keep on doing this, keep on addressing issues that might happen in the future before the problem even arises.
I just want to add a note for viewers who may not be familiar with the Everest Valley. Lukla is the place you fly to from Kathmandu in general. And then from there, you have to walk up to base camp, but there are helicopters. And so some people just buy helicopter trips to expedite their visit. And Dawa, you work in tourism. So this is also how you make money and what you do for a living. So what's the right balance between offering packages, offering comfort, convincing tourists to come, but also protecting the environment and thinking about what the mountain can actually sustain?
I think it's been proven now that in places like Nepal, where tourism is, where the local people are so dependent upon tourism, that tourism needs to go hand in hand with environmental conservation. Because if they go at if they're at odds with each other, it's going to do more damage to both sides. Let me give you an example. Some of the places that are as beautiful as the Everest region in Nepal that see no tourists, wildlife poaching, wildlife smuggling, as well as illegal timber. I mean, those are the biggest industries if tourism isn't there. So tourism is a force for good because it makes people protect the natural environment because they understand that there is a financial or economic value in keeping it, let alone, of course, the spiritual and even the emotional value of having a pristine environment. But, at the end of the day, if it impacts the fact that you, whether your kids can go to school or not, if you can, you know, buy new clothes for your wife or not, those are important things as a provider in your family. And if you can't answer that, then you are going to find for an alternative solution to make sure that you can provide for your family. And if it's not tourism, it'll be something worse. So tourism is a force for good in the context of Nepal. And the type of tourists that we get here are normally also people who love the mountains, who love the natural environment. That's why they go through the pain of walking weeks on end through the mountains, right? And so this is the type of tourism that we want.
As you both mentioned, all these environmental issues we've been talking about have consequences. They are interrelated and they have far-reaching effects. If you think that roughly 1 billion people in Indian China rely on the Himalayas for water, for example. And if we start at the top of the mountain, climbers are first in line to witness the damage brought by higher temperatures. Now, climbing has always been dangerous, but Conrad, is it even more dangerous now because of climate change?
My observation on the Khumbu Icefall and some of the higher angle, steeper routes is that they are becoming safer and easier with climate change. And everyone's going to freak out. The Economist had an article just this past May saying that 17 deaths, 11 of those deaths of last year, which is the highest year of mortality on Everest, were due to inexperience. But imagine, if you will, a river coming down at flood stage. And if you're a boater, a kayaker, you understand it's absolutely crazy and everything like that. When it's really low water, you can sneak around, and lower water is more tranquil. So there's, it's more dangerous in the height of summer when the ice is not holding things together. So if you've tried to chip ice off of your sidewalk, and you live in a cold climate, when it's really frozen, you understand how important that is. And then when there's a little bit of water underneath, you can move it all off in a day. And we hit those tipping points. When people are in the mountains in these climate tipping points, warm events, yes, it's going to be more dangerous. But Dawa and I were talking about the fact that there's less ice coming down through the ice fall. It's not being replenished. Yes, it's still a very dangerous place, but you don't have that mass of water cascading down. So, and routes that I've observed over the decades in the Khumbu, they're what was a hanging glacier with a serac, a crumbly edge, and it calves off and falls down. Those have now melted back, and the mountains aren't quite as fearful as they once were. They don't have that power to them. So, but again, this is my observation, and we're going to break with the norm here on the Thin Ice podcast, because Dawa and Conrad are like, yeah, there's less ice there, and it's not moving as fast, and things, we have other things to be concerned about.
Yeah, so just talking about Everest and the dangers there, what I have noticed is not on the climbing route itself, so like not on the ice fall, but on the western shoulder, on the Lola Pass, that we're getting much bigger avalanches coming off of that. And every year the glacier does seem to be receding higher and higher up. And I remember in 2010, there was a huge avalanche that came through from the Lola Pass and dusted all of base camp. And then the icefall doctor at the time, Ang Nima, and my uncle Parthemba, both at that time in their 60s, both said, wow, that's the biggest avalanche we've ever seen at base camp. And, I was quite surprised by that, to be able to witness something like that, and today those avalanches coming from the Lola Pass for the western shoulder, they're happening quite frequently, the ones that come all the way into base camp and dust everything. Last year, in the fall, I had a team at base camp, well away from Nuptse. Nuptse is another mountain on the Everest Massif. And there was an avalanche that came off of Nuptse, probably one of the little tongues that, coming down from the Nuptse. Is that the west face, I want to say?
Yeah, northwest face.
Northwest face. And it actually blew the entire camp away, and it injured a couple of my Sherpas. And this was you know, it was in October, early October. So, you know, these sort of things are happening quite often now. So I don't know. I think it's a transition phase. And when all that ice is gone from above base camp and then it recedes far enough back, that base camp's going to be fine. But in the meantime, we are seeing these big, big avalanches coming and hitting base camp, not always injuring anybody, but anybody who's close to that, like when they're going on their way to the icefall, or if they're in the icefall and it's coming from the western shoulder, then there is you know, potential to get hurt or killed. And in fact, in 2014, that did happen, and over a dozen Sherpas did get killed in an event like that. And I hope that, in a way, either the seracs stop melting and grow again and don't collapse so often, or they completely melt away so that they don't collapse. Because at the end of the day, the result is that people are getting killed.
Dawa, with your expedition company, you take the responsibility of bringing people to the top of the highest mountains on Earth, and the risk of death is very real. Is that getting more complicated now, and how do you navigate those risks?
I think the biggest risk, and has always been, is when it comes to mountaineering, is the weather. And although technology has greatly improved in recent years, and so the number of people getting caught out in bad weather and getting killed is far less now than it used to be in the past. Every meteorologist that I speak to is saying that the weather is getting more and more unpredictable, and severe weather systems are more and more becoming the norm now. So leaving everything aside, just not being able to know what the weather is going to be doing and the severity of that, the weather, if it becomes, you know, malicious, is the consequences are going to be much more serious. At the end of the day, when something goes wrong at high altitude, it's the Sherpas that have to come in there and save the day. And as long as you have enough Sherpas on your team who are able to do that work, to execute a rescue operation or whatever they need may be, then you have a better chance of being safe on the mountain. Then, of course, having more oxygen available, more resources available, all of that. Unfortunately, though, that all costs money. And the trend on Everest is to sell cheaper and cheaper, not, you know, sell better and better. And that, unfortunately, does put climbers at risk, both Sherpas and foreign climbers.
Conrad, of course, you have had a lot of experiences and you've seen things going wrong. People who have watched your films know that you have experienced grief and the death of climbing partners and close friends. I hope you don't mind me asking, but has that changed your perspective on climbing and the way you approach your practice?
Yeah, climbing is what I do. It's been my life, and it comes at a steep cost in terms of loss of people and all that. But I'm also an atheist. I live in the moment. I live in the present. I appreciate people. And yeah, if climbing brings me joy, I'm going to keep doing it. So I don't know how to answer that. I still struggle with it before I go to sleep. With the family and having raised our boys, they're now adults. The consequences of loss are pretty significant. But at the end of the day, with 7 billion people where we're at now on this planet, and as long as you're not harming other people and you're not undue harm to the environment, then we should, and climbers are good people. I mean, when Dawa and I climb together, it's he and I are the team. Our enemy is gravity, the weather, some of the things we talked about. But of course, when we play some sport, we have a shape made by humans with a clock, a ball, rules, all that other stuff. And we're pitting human against human. And so we're creating an artificial sense. And that's what team sports are and why we love watching football matches and the World Cup and all of that. We get it. But the basis of way in which humans communicate when they're in outdoors taps into this very primal, like this, the oldest part of being human. We're still out there and we're still going against the environment, and building that connection with people is, that's the magic of climbing.
Dawa, the Sherpa community, of course, also faces these questions every day. As you said, Sherpas have to come in and save the day if something goes wrong. So how do you feel about these dangers and about this risk?
It is a business that me and my family have been in. I mean, I was born into this, into climbing, into mountaineering. And we, like Conrad, we have lost so many good people. And it's the it's one of those things, you know, that when you say bye to someone, there's always something, you know, in the back of your head, you know, and you always pray. I mean, I am spiritual. I'm a Buddhist, and I do my prayers. I know there's a good life after this one for those who do good, and that's what I believe in. And that's, you know, that's why I do a lot of the things I do. I know that, you know, working in the mountains and trying to make it a better place will give me more merit for the next life. But at least when it comes to this life, you know, I would also like to see that, you know, we are safe. I myself, as well as all the climbers that come with me, all my Sherpas. Yeah, it's very tough. But like I said, there are very few alternatives to this. And especially in a country like Nepal, the biggest source of employment for young people in Nepal is to go and work as migrant laborers in the Middle East, in the Gulf countries, which arguably is not much safer than climbing in the mountains. So, you know, given the choice, I mountaineering is better, because at least you're in your own country, you have respect, global respect, and you make equal pay or even more pay than you would do in the Gulf countries. So if we could just make it safer, if we could make it better in any way, then, you know, we need to put every effort behind it.
Now, circling back to our main question before we wrap up, what can actually be done to protect Everest and people on it?
Everest is going to be there. But it is a barometer of what we're doing to the environment. And so if we can't figure out the Everglades in Florida, which is a swampland, and we can't listen to what Everest is telling us, then we're muting the information that the world is giving humanity on how to address climate change. And in that sense, specifically to Everest, a comprehensive carrying capacity study that would be outline how many climbers can visit the mountain from a ecological planet standpoint, health of the glaciers, a sociological standpoint, a cultural standpoint, and an aesthetic standpoint, building all that in there. So Denali in North America, highest point there, has a carrying capacity of 1,400 climbers a season. Aconcagua, Mont Blanc, a lot of these popular mountains have that. And once there's that carrying capacity, you can address how people get there three different ways. One is the old school way, which was ability. If you're not good enough, the mountain's going to sort you out. And that's, but now with a strong infrastructure, you can do it by money, which is at $11,000 this season, $15,000 next year, is a pretty high barrier to go into it. Or you can do it by complete lottery. So just randomize numbers and your number is there.
You have both mentioned that you both want to do something about this. What would you like your legacy to be in terms of environmentalism?
Yeah, they're raising awareness and understanding and sharing the knowledge. So yeah, it's difficult to, you know, being as a person I am, being born into white privilege. I was introduced to climbing by my parents, and so I got a head start, and I've been able to live a life of leisure climbing mountains. And so there's but raising awareness and bringing the conversation to the people that have power and hopefully holding them accountable. But it's also I don't wake up in the morning, think about my legacy. I wake up in the morning and hold on, because life is taking off. Every day is a new adventure. but one thing, if I may, to comment before we, in the process of wrapping this up, for Dawa Stephen and his family, he mentioned that they were 19 generations that they were there since they immigrated over from Tibet, and that it's only been 73 years since 1951 when the first Western expedition came into the Khumbu. And that's three generations. And to see from subsistence agriculture, and to see that amount of change in three generations is remarkable, and is very fast from when we think about things.
So it's all happening very quickly. And does that also give us hope that we can turn things around very quickly as well?
Turning around global CO2 levels isn't going to happen quickly. I mean, we have really got to work on it. We're at this point in human civilization where we know what's happening to the atmosphere. This blanket of CO2 and methane that we're putting up there is a result of human activity. And we're seeing the fastest warming in the last million years, or as best we can scientifically ascertain, in a short period of time. And the rate it's going now, that within 100 years, the Himalaya could be completely ice-free. Unless we can adhere to the global warming targets that we have, and collectively as a humanity, I don't want to sound like a pessimist, but it's pretty serious. I mean, climate change is, Nepal is a consequence nation. They're taking the consequences of a high per capita fossil fuel consumption, which is myself as a citizen of the United States. And they suffer the consequences, yet your nation isn't responsible for the amount of consequences you will say.
From my side, coming back to what I said in the beginning, you know, in the short term, there's not much we can do about the mountains. About the melting, doesn't mean that we shouldn't, because in the long term, something will change. It'll have to change. But at this time, myself, I'm focused more on helping the local people, helping the Sherpa people from the Khumbu Valley specifically in addressing all these problems. So from garbage, from climate change. So another thing that we've, another project that we've also done successfully is to build the flood barriers at Feriche, which is directly below the Khumbu Glacier. So Bali Peak Outlook and myself, we implemented that project with the local municipality, with the local government. And we plan to do many more. And so addressing any problems that the local municipality might have flagged up, you know, we'll see how we can get involved and do that. And so in the short term, it's more about saving lives and livelihoods for me, because the problem's already here. But having said that, the root of the problem is climate change, which requires a long-term approach. And as I mentioned earlier, we've been here for 19 generations. My family has been in the Everest region now for 19 generations. And, I'm just part of that legacy. And, you know, my great-grandfather was the first bamboo, the first leader of the Everest region, officially recognized by the Nepal government. That was my great-grandfather. My grandfather was called the protector of the Sherpa heritage by the abbot of the Tenguche Monastery. My dad was one of the first people to get a Western education, and he did a lot of things in mountaineering, in steering mountaineering policy in Nepal, and I hope to continue with that legacy going forward. And I think my call is in addressing the issues of climate change and making sure my people are going to be safe in the future addressing climate change.
Well, I'm sure not only in Nepal, Dawa, but everywhere in the world, there will be alpinists who will be inspired. Thank you so much for our conversation today. There is much more to say about environmental protection and what's happening on Everest is affecting the rest of the world, as you both mentioned. And that's something we'll keep covering and we'll cover more in depth in future episodes. I'd like to thank for now our great production team. On Tonight has original music by Nadir Kassim. Our script editor and editorial advisor is Dave Vetter. And thanks, as always, to the Ballypeak Outlook Foundation for supporting this podcast. The foundation, as you explained, Dawa, aims to defend mountains in Nepal and around the world from the impact of climate change and excessive tourism. Check out their website. That's ballypeakoutlook.org. ballypeakoutlook.org. It's also on your vest, Dawa, so it's easy to find. On Thin Ice is a production by Iceworm Media. Make sure to hit the subscribe button and download our shows. Please also give us a review on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time. Goodbye.